Hello?
Blog Talk Radio.
I'm going around the horn. Make your go-no-goes based on the data you had prior to LOS. I see we got it back. Give you another few seconds.
We're going fine.
Okay, retro.
Go.
Vital.
Go.
Guide.
Go.
Control.
Go.
Telcom.
Go.
GNC.
Go.
Econ.
Go.
Surgeon.
Go.
Capcom. We're go to continue PDI.
Coming to you live from the slopes of the ghost-filled Sierra Nevada gold country and in the paranormally active shadow of Mount Rainier, it's Ghost Rider Paranormal Radio with your hosts, John Almada and Kat Lang.
And hello, Sunday it is, and it's also, I believe, the longest day of the year, June 21st, 2009, and after a few panicked moments of telephone difficulties, we resorted to the Skype line, and Kat's here with me, and we just got back from Bodie and did quite an investigation there, so just kind of took the day to rest up and do some Father's Day stuff, so my father was treated like a king today and was kind of resting easy too. So that's what's going on. Hope all of you guys had a great Father's Day and took Dad out and did some neat stuff. Kat, what's up with your section of the world today?
Not a lot. Just hanging out on a Sunday.
Hanging out on a Sunday. Okay. Well, we did pretty good for what we went through on Friday and Saturday. Drove to Bodie in the early morning. We took off and got after a 911 call to the police on the way over Highway 50 because we had a drunk driver in front of us who actually wrecked his car right in front of us and then sped off at 90 miles an hour with us on the phone with the CHP. That was our good deed for the trip. And then we made our way down and stopped off at the Bodie Victorian Hotel, which looked every bit of the bordello that it appeared to be and was talked about its history. They kept a lot of the things the same in it, and you walked in, and it was just a very interesting place with its six-degree tilted stairs and all. So it was definitely one of those spooky places that you read about, and it's a great experience to do, and I recommend it to anybody. We got to Bodie about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It took our time getting down, and it was a long trip, but we got to Bodie. Very, very windy, but cool, sunny day, with some clouds. And it was just unbelievable. I don't know if any of you in the chat room have ever been there, but if you do get the chance to go to Bodie before it closes on July 1st because of the budget crisis out here in California, I recommend highly, you know, that you do that, because we got great EVPs. Some of the initial analysis we did this morning, we got some really good stuff. So I really recommend it to anybody who, you know, likes paranormal investigation, or if you just want to go out and see some neat architecture and see how people lived in the, you know, 1800s and in actual, you know, implements and things that they used in their day-to-day life, I highly recommend it. So that said, let's go on with the show tonight. What we have is we have a special guest. We have an actual paranormal fiction author whose name is Elizabeth Egan Cox. And because of our technical difficulties, I'm going to have to ask Kat to use her special calling skills with her setup, because mine is currently experiencing some problems. So at about 8:30, we'll bring Elizabeth on, and I'll make sure Kat's got the number. I think I had that in the show notes I sent you, Kat. So if you could do that, we would be most appreciative, because I was desperate here with this. This whole rig was just not, it was totally acting up on me. Anyway, so that said, let's go on with the news of the week. We're going to jump into that a little bit early. And Kat, I'm having a little fun with the consoles even today on Blog Talk. It's just one of those technically challenging days. So if you do your standard news noise. Okay. Thank you. And what we've got today is three stories: Hunter versus Hunter, Park District Leads Ghost Hunt, and Explore Berlin's Haunted Past. So if we go to, let me see, Hunter versus Hunter. This is from PR NewsWeb. It's live broadcast event. Hunter versus Hunter, world-breaking internet broadcast event, new paranormal interactive on-demand capability, the surprise event of the summer. Hoo-hoo. So this story is from today, June 21st, 2009, live from the USS North Carolina on July 15th, 2009. It's the world premiere broadcast event, Hunter versus Hunter, with the godfather of the paranormal, John Zaffis, and True TV's Patrick Burns, who I just saw the other day over at Wolf Manor, from Haunting Evidence, Michael White, the winner of Lifetime TV's Greatest Psychic Challenge and host of Para-X's new radio show, Supernatural Encounters, Mona Leeson, and Nathan, and more. The first ever live interactive audience participated paranormal broadcast where you decide who the winner will be. So the audience is actually going to make these decisions. Cool. Streaming via satellite through 11 cameras with full on-demand interactive capability and insight button, with special guest celebrities from all walks of life. This is the first audience participated interactive broadcast of its kind, and supported by Team UPI's Real Core Evidence Analysis Team, three of the nation's most outstanding paranormal teams will go toe-to-toe, head-to-head, in Hunter versus Hunter. So these three carefully selected teams will compete and investigate alongside some of the hottest celebrities in the field. And all three teams will win large equipment prize packages, including thermal cameras and more, with the grand prize to include the M5 thermal camera. And so don't miss out on this one. It looks to be pretty interesting. And again, you can see this on the GRA homepage. Just go check the link out there, and you can read up on it. We'll skip over here to the Park District to lead Ghost Hunt. This is from the NewarkAdvocate.com. And from Granville, this story is from today, June 21st. Granville, curious about the paranormal and interested in experiencing sudden temperature changes and things that go bump in the dark, eerie noises and apparitions, the Licking Park District's Ghost Hunt at the Reformatory Tour might be the experience for you. Join the Licking Park District and Michael Robert, founder of Central Ohio Paranormal Society, on July 24th for a night of ghost hunting at the historic Ohio State Reformatory in Mansfield. Once home to Ohio's criminals, the Reformatory is now a historic site dedicated to education and unique experiences. This will be extended for an extended overnight tour. No accommodations to be provided, only ghost hunting. Participants must be 21 years or older, and it's a $125 per person fee for the trip, including transportation to and from the reformatory and a pizza dinner before the beginning of the hunt. And if you register, Park Express members will receive a 10% discount on their reservation. Deadline for the registration is end of this month, June 30th. So that looks like fun. If you live in the Ohio area, give that a look. Let's move on to GoBeachComber.com Entertainment. This is also from, I don't think I have actual date on this, but it says here, Berlin will be celebrating more than one type of spirit this summer, according to its thanks to its newest business. The Spirits of Berlin Ghost Tour began operating in historic Berlin on Wednesday. The new business offers a 90-minute walking tour that highlights the legend and lore of the town. People are going to have a wonderful time, said Peggy Schmidt, along with Andrea Martin, who created Ghost Tours of America 4 years ago. They'll learn a little bit about the local history and the ghosts. And it goes on to say here, Schmidt and Martin selected Berlin to be the fourth city to feature on one of their ghost tours, which are already popular in Phoenixville, Philadelphia, and in two cities in North Carolina. Schmidt said that the small Maryland town of Berlin was their choice because it was very walkable and featured an attractive downtown. So it goes on. It's a fairly long article, but give that a look, too, if you live in the East Coast and wanted to drive up and take a look at that. And that's it for the news. So anyway, going back to, let me flip back here to where what we're going to be talking about tonight. Yeah, we're going to be talking with Elizabeth Egan Cox, and we're probably a little bit early to kind of dive into that, but I kind of just wanted to say a little bit about her because she was good enough to send two PDF books. And Kat, did you happen to get a chance to read either of those?
No, I did not. I'm sorry. I didn't get a chance to look at them, but I have heard of her, and she writes some very interesting material.
Yeah, I took the time to reread them. I read them early on, and then I reread them again. I got up this morning and reread both. So it was about 3.5 hour read fest just to make sure I was up to speed on everything in there. And the way she writes is pretty. It's kind of in an interesting style. Let me see here if I can write. This is from one of the letters she sent me. I write cozy mysteries that are paranormal because there are ghosts in them and that the ghosts are treated as characters pertinent to the plot, not as novelties. One ghost, a Scottish magician, turned out to be a fairly helpful ghost. And by the definition of cozy as a mystery, it means G-rated. So if you're not familiar with the genre, I can't say the word today. I am not talking right. It's been genre. Think Agatha Christie, and she was the queen of cozies. There's no explicit or graphic language, horror, or sex, so it's very readable. And I recommend to anyone who's out there who has kids who want to learn a little bit about the paranormal, but you don't want to do it. Anybody from about, I'd say, maybe 8 years on is going to enjoy these books. And I know I did. I thought they were well written, and I just kept reading and reading and enjoyed them. So I'm interested to find out more about what she's what got her into this, and to find out what her thinking was as far as coming up with these plots and who her role model was. I would guess that Agatha Christie was her role model here. Do you read a lot of mysteries, Kat?
No, I don't read a lot of books. I'm not the reader person. I watch movies and DVDs, and I listen to them on tape.
Oh, yeah, like books on tape, things like that?
Right, yeah.
Well, heck, we'll have to see if she's going to do a books on tape type of thing here tonight. But anyway, we'll kind of put that aside and talk about Bodhi and some of the things that happened out there.
I found an interesting video that was sent to me today on Comcast for Father's Day, and if you watch the video, Dale Earnhardt Jr. got into a very bad car accident in Sonoma, and his car caught fire. And if you watch the video, you can see him getting out of his car, and it and he's being lifted up by underneath his arms and dragged out of the window.
By who?
His father.
What?
They interviewed him on 60 Minutes, and he said that he had his PR man by the collar in the medical tent, and he demanded to know who pulled him out of the car. And his PR manager looked at him and said, "Dale, nobody was standing behind you to pull you out of the car." And Dale says somebody picked him up underneath his arms and pulled him out of the window. And if you watch the video of the accident, you can see him being lifted underneath his arms and pulled out of the window of a burning vehicle. And there was nobody standing there.
Oh, my God.
And they asked him point blank, "Do you think it was your father?" And he said, "I know it was my dad."
Wow, because this happened this weekend?
Yeah.
Yeah, we just drove through Sonoma on the way back. I'm just, wow, I didn't even know they had a racetrack there. So, oh, my God.
If you watch the video, you can see him clearly. He had a car on fire, flames shooting 30 feet in the air, and then you can see him. His arms are, you know, raised up on either side like somebody was picking him up, and he just got drugged smooth out of the window, and there's nobody standing there. There's nobody doing it.
Well, I'll tell you what, if anybody was that kind of person to do that, it would be his father. I mean, the Dominator, that guy's a legend, and I'm sure he loved his son enough to do something to come over from the other side to help him. I mean, that's just amazing.
It's an amazing video. And it almost makes him cry to see it.
Is it on YouTube?
I got it on Comcast. I can send you the link to it.
Okay, yeah, we'll go ahead and put that on to the GRI homepage right after
the
show.
It's an amazing video.
Sure. Good Lord. Are people commenting on that? They're seeing that all over? Commenting on what they're seeing?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
You can see it. It's real visual.
Wow. I mean, to get that on a sports TV, to have a paranormal
mm-hmm.
event in front of everyone, that's insane.
mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness.
He floats out of the window. It's weird.
You know, how bad was he hurt? I mean,
he has not a scratch on him. Not one hair singed.
And the interview afterwards is also on the tape?
Yes.
You know, with him?
Yes.
Okay, so somebody spliced and put that together, and we'll
yes.
have to take a
yeah.
look at this.
NASCAR did it. ESPN.
Oh,
ESPN Sports did it. They couldn't believe it either.
Well, that's going to be checked out by a whole lot of people in our field. Let me tell you what. That's really just great. I did not even hear about that. Was that yesterday or Saturday?
Saturday.
I mean, Friday. It was Saturday?
Saturday.
Oh, my God.
Was it Saturday? I think it was the trials on Saturday. I know it was. I don't believe it was today.
Well,
but yeah, he's a little freaked out at this point. That was his father that did that, and he is actually. It's not a misconstruement. There is. It looks like somebody's behind him.
Well,
but nobody was near him. Nobody.
Well, I tend to think that. That dear old dad showed up just in the nick of time. I mean, that was a life and death thing.
I'm sure he did.
Some of the callers are going, wow, and oh, cool, not callers, but our folks in the chat room.
Oh, the race was today. Thank you, Kestrel. Yeah, well, I would think it was Sunday, so anyways, it's an interesting video, and it's very clear. It's a dead-on shot. You can literally see him float out of that window.
And the car was just completely totaled, right?
The car's completely engulfed in flames 30 feet high.
Whoa.
I do mean completely engulfed.
Have you ever heard of anything else like that before with in racing or in any other kind of, you know, I mean, I'm trying to think of anything I could have that would compare, and there's just not much that you could...
I've heard of things like that occurring, but it's only a story. I've never seen a video like that, no.
Huh.
You always hear about people thinking that, or thinking they see, or thinking they feel, or a bystander thinks they see or thinks they feel, but you never see an actual video of this is what happened, and it is an actual video from ESPN. It's not doctored, it's not filtered, it's not made up, it's a real video, and it's of Dale being lifted out of the car by something that isn't there.
I think that's going to be a classic that's this is going to be played all over the place.
Well, they've been showing it. I clicked over to ESPN. They've been showing it. And they're like, I can't believe this. I cannot believe this video. I can't believe them. I couldn't believe it. I was like, oh, my God.
That's good. That's cool. I'm glad you brought that up. We
it's the Intimidator.
Got to check this out. Yeah. Oh, my God. Well,
I had a really good interview today on my show, so I was really excited about it. And Kathy was there, and Doc John was there, and some other people were there. I had a really good time today.
Who was on?
I talked to Callie Sack. She is the tour guide and the resident paranormal investigator at the Stanley Hotel.
Oh my, that sounds like
she
a
gave
great
me.
Interview.
She gave me 2 hours of her time. So she moved a ghost tour to talk to me, and it was an explosive interview, and it was just, I couldn't believe it. I was like, wow. So I'm going to the Stanley for Halloween for the Shining, they call it the Shining Ball.
And, oh, my God.
It's at the Stanley, and I've been invited, so I am going.
Good for you. That's going to be great. Gosh darn. What was the interview like? I mean, I'll have to listen to it on the archive, but was she full of stories about the things that go on there?
Yeah, and actually, when I was talking to her, I did some sensitive work because I was tuning into her, and I was dead on. She says, you're just dead on. You're giving me goosebumps.
Well, I'll be darned. Well, more affirmations
cool.
about what you do. So, hey, very cool. Well, I just want you to know, I just sent you the phone number for our guest. So it should be in your mailbox so we can have you do the call.
Yeah, I have
if
it.
If you'd be so good to connect.
Hunter says that incident with Dale happened a few years ago. I'm sorry. I don't know why they were just showing. Maybe they were just showing it on Comcast because it's Father's Day.
Well, I'll be darned. So, okay, so it's not a recent incident. And,
well,
but yeah, if you could send the link, that'd be great. And then we'll check that out. That's the first I've ever heard of this.
It was. It doesn't really matter to me how old it is. It is an amazing video, and Dale's just like, yeah, it was my dad. He was being interviewed by what's his name? Not Morley Safer, but what's his name? I can't remember. He's on 60 Minutes. So that's what's going on.
Okay. Well, we returned from Bodie, and really were happy with the results of that investigation. Again, I brought up that July 1st is the closing date, and there was actually a petition to try to keep the park open, and we all signed that because it's just such a beautiful place, and it doesn't look like it takes that much to keep it open. The desert region around there is not going to be tearing it down that fast, but evidently, I guess our state government thinks that they'll save some money for the interim, and hopefully, if they do shut it down, they'll keep caretakers there to make sure nothing gets stolen, because there's just such history there. But within minutes, just our first analysis on EVPs were really good. We had what sounded like a kid saying, hey, help, or hey, hello. We can't decide which that is. Followed almost immediately by a male voice whispering very clearly, get out. And after that, it was just we had some female voices inside some of the buildings, and one who identified herself as Lucy, and another extremely clear one. One actually said we were there making fun of the ghost. They were referencing themselves. So we're just, you know, we're really just thrilled with what we got out of that. I was surprised that they feel the way they do. They really just kind of want their peace there in that place. At least some of them feel that way. Others were fairly friendly that we got on some of the EVP and the evidence we got. So not sure what to make of it all. We got a lot more to go through, and we haven't even started on the Victorian hotel evidence, which we had a few strange experiences there, but nothing like we had at Bodie. So should be interesting to see what comes up in the future on that. And we'll definitely have some of our folks who were on that particular case back on the show when we do some review of that and talk about the whole experience. So that said, we're coming up on our break time for that special time that you folks all may need to take whatever it is you need to take at the half-hour break, as Kat would say. What does she say?
Go pee!
Yep, that's what she says. So let's go ahead and launch into some music while Kat gets our guest on the line.
Okay.
And we will be back to talk with Elizabeth Egan Cox about her books. And thank you for being here on Blog Talk Radio with Ghostwriter Paranormal Investigations. And I got to talk about my group here, Ghostwriter Paranormal Radio. And we're going to play Break Cats Can Dance. Here we go.
Sensible, 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 s
my, cats can't dance. I like that song. So, Kat, have we got Elizabeth with us?
We have Miss Elizabeth Egan-Cox with us. Welcome, Elizabeth, to the show.
Well, thank you, John and Kat. I am
Yes, thank you.
Okay, there we go. We're already talking over each other.
Well, good to have you aboard.
That music kind of reminded me of old rubber band folk music. And I haven't heard that in... I was down in New Orleans the year before Katrina, and there was that kind of, I don't know what you call that kind of a band, but it's true. There's a musician on every corner down in the Bourbon Street area, and there was, I think it was a trio of musicians, and they were playing that kind of rubber band music.
Huh. Yeah, I like that. You go down into any city center, but especially down in that part of the United States, and they are just really good at that. They've got the Caribbean influence mixed with, French Quarter, and all kinds of different rhythms that just come out in wild ways. And I'm not quite sure. It's by a guy named David Electric. Here is what this one is, and it's called "Cats Can Dance." And so it was just something we picked out. I like the beat, and we throw it on there every once in a while. And it's named Cats Can Dance, and I thought of cats. So anyway, I was really interested when you sent us the letter on Blog Talk about your books, and then we got talking, you and I, and you sent the books, and I've read them twice now, each one. I really loved them too. By the way, I have to admit, what happens to in the second book, and I'm not going to give the title away, but what happens to the one character who basically gets a second chance, if we will? I thought that was interesting, and you kind of keep it on the edge. You never know quite what she's thinking.
Shannon Delaney, who is the lead character. A young woman who is a business writer. People often ask me, what part of Shannon Delaney is me? Well, the only part is the fact that she is a business writer, because I used to do that. I used to write corporate histories for some of America's most prestigious companies. Billabong, the extreme sportswear company, Fashion 21, and so on and so forth. And so that really is the only part of the lead character, Shannon Delaney, that is like me. And I had to give her first of all, she needed a profession that I knew something about, and it would allow her to travel, and to work kind of freelance. So that worked out really well. Otherwise, Shannon is a composite of many, many different women that I have known in my family and, in my circle of friends, and sometimes just in a circle of acquaintances that I've met when I've been traveling and so on and so forth. But lots of people have said that book two is more interesting. But book one had to serve the purpose of laying the groundwork for the whole series, because even though each book in and of itself is a standalone mystery, because it's a serial, Shannon's life and the characters that are in her circle, there has to be a subtext that continues from one book to the next, to the next, and to the next.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, and I saw that. I mean, the way you carried on with even some of the lesser characters, mm-hmm. The nun, that came through in the second one and just played on, and of course the both gentlemen who were in competition, shall we say, for certain affections.
Yeah.
That was really good, and I could never make my mind up which guy was going to do well in her eyes, and I'm looking at book three going, oh man, I got to get book three now, I got to see what's going to happen, because, again, I won't give away what happened to one of them, but something happened, and that something was, shall we say, it complicates everything. So your timing devices were really good in there too, how the nun would always show up just at the right time. And I just thought that was good.
thank you. I am halfway. Actually, I'm three-fifths of the way writing book three. My target each year is I start in March to write a book, and I want to be finished before I go on vacation. I always go on vacation over Halloween week. We usually leave around October 26th, and then we come back around November 3rd or November 4th, depending on where we're going. And I don't like having that hang over my head when I go on vacation.
Right.
Yeah, and it actually only takes me about 5 months to do the writing, but something will always come up. This year on May 15th, my dog had to have surgery, and so I live in a three-story home. It's not a large home, but it's three stories, and my office mm-hmm. is in the loft, which is two staircases up, and I cannot take her up and downstairs. We were just able this week to take her up to the great room, which is street level. That's where the living room and kitchen and main bath are. And then at night, we take her back down. So she's back down here in the basement level. And, you know, I say basement, but it's actually part of the home. It's not a basement. It's a walkout basement, but it is the basement level. And so that's been a huge interruption. But, you know, she's my best pal, and she would do this for me. And it's not often that your dog goes through. It's like a knee replacement.
Oof.
I know.
Oh, boy.
She's now bionic. She has a stainless steel rod in the part of the leg that's below the knee, and she has a stainless steel kneecap.
Wow.
Yeah, it's quite a
cybernetic dog.
Yes, exactly. I tell people she's bionic, and I'm a nervous wreck. But and so that has been somewhat of an interruption, but it was planned for, because something will always come up, you know. So.
Well,
it's in the making.
Yeah, go. So, how you did the corporate writing, and that obviously honed your skills, but the paranormal angle. How did this come to you to pick paranormal fiction? And is any of it based on any personal experiences you've had, or can you kind of give us a grounding in what set you in motion?
Yeah, you know, I actually have two books out that are nonfiction, and they're on California and Old West history. Here, especially in Southern California, I'm known as a California historian, and I got really tired of writing nonfiction. I used to write two monthly columns, and I would still be doing that had the publications not folded. And quite honestly, one publication was in business for 30 years, and the other one was in business for probably at least that long. And they just kind of folded. They closed up shop. They couldn't find anyone to buy the publication, so they closed up. And I kind of sighed and thought, okay, I'm not tied in. I don't have that ball and chain around me anymore. Because that really is what a column is when you're doing nonfiction, because nonfiction has got to be backed up with solid evidence of what you're writing. And so, you know, there's a whole lot of research in there. I'm not quite sure. I think I just, I got the bug. And I decided that I have this, really, it's a wealth of background information about California history, American history of the 1800s, which was sort of my specialty. And I thought, if I could find a publisher who will allow me to write and then will allow me to have a section in the back of the book that explains some of the historical aspects, then I thought, I'll do it. And actually, lo and behold, the second publisher that I proposed the series to said, I love the idea that you're going to write fiction, you're going to include actual historical events and people in your stories, and you're willing to substantiate that by giving, you know, trivia kind of background in the back of the book. Paranormal. First of all, a year ago, I didn't even know what the term paranormal was. To me, paranormal is what I would have called supernatural. And the aspect of using character or characters, there is one main character who is a ghost. And I can say who that is. He's a Scottish magician who lived in the late 1800s in San Diego. And there are other ghosts that appear from time to time. But I had told the publisher, I said, you know, I don't want to go novelty with this. I want the readers to understand that the ghosts are spirits with a spectral reason for their existence. And so I write them as characters. They're not there just for the scare aspect or the aspect of bringing a sense of history into it. They're very, very critical to the plot. And as the plot moves along, I can tell you that the Scottish magician, Eric Blackthorne, becomes a little bit more prominent.
Hmm.
Where does this come from? Blood memory. And, you know, I think I told you that I had proposed talking a little bit about the paranormal in Celtic culture. I am so Celtic, and I can say that because my ancestry here in America goes back, well, to the 1600s. I've actually stood in Virginia inside of a church that my family built in 1701, and the church is still standing.
Wow.
That was my McCorley family, and they're actually listed on the roster of America's First Families. That's not unusual for Virginians. Anyone who has that kind of history that goes back to the Jamestown era or goes back in New England to the Pilgrim era or out here in California, because in my books I include a lot about the original founding Hispanic culture, it's not unusual out here to meet someone whose family goes back to the Spanish colonization of California. Well, all of my ancestry is Irish and Scottish, a little bit Welsh, a little bit English. And for those of you out there, I'm a member of the National Society Daughters of the American Revolution, better known in American culture and in the old Gilmore Girls TV show as DAR. So, you know, all joking aside, when it comes to DAR, you have to have very hard evidential proof in direct lineage, going back to a person who served in the founding through the Revolutionary War efforts of Americans. So far, I've been able to document 4 in my family. And that's how I know on my mom's side, as well as partly on my father's side, that these are all Scottish and Irish who were also here very early in America in the 1600s. And then on my father's side, my name of Egan actually comes from the clan MacEgan. And I'm a member of that clan, and we still have our castle in Ireland. It's called Redwood Castle. It's near County Tipperary. So I kind of grew up very much within the Celtic culture. I'm a member of, I don't mind telling people this, I'm Episcopalian, which is also called Anglican Catholic, and that was the Church of Jamestown when John Smith came over here and everyone else came over here in Virginia in 1607. That it was the Anglican Catholic Church, which became the Episcopal Church after the Revolution. Something happened after the Revolution. The Archbishop of Canterbury did not want to ordain our priests, so we had to send our priests to Aberdeen, Scotland, to be ordained. And so the American Church of the Anglican Catholic denomination is called Episcopal here in the U.S., and we pay homage to our Scottish roots. Anyway, that whole Anglican Catholic Church, this is the church that has in its custody the Book of Kells. And so the Celtic nature within the Anglican Catholic denomination is very strong. We use the Trinity knot. This is the church that uses the Celtic cross. That is our main symbol. And I grew up with that. And so to write something that was paranormal was natural to me. But as I said, I never had really heard of the term paranormal. To me, it was going to be supernatural. That's the term I would have used. And it is related to personal experiences. It's when you grow up Celtic, you're not afraid to talk about ghosts and what we would call spirit visitation. In fact, in book one, the nun, Sister Rosario Santiago, who, by the way, has probably more Czech writing power than most CEOs. and if you notice, I never ever mention the denomination she is. All the Catholic denominations, whether it's Anglican, Roman, or Orthodox, have orders of nuns. So I let people kind of read into that whatever they want to. But anyway, it was just something we grew up with, being really close to that sense of spirit visitation and what I call Shannon's ability to talk to the past is what we would call intuitive intelligence. And all of that came over here with the founding of Jamestown in 1607. By the way, Jamestown was founded over a decade earlier before the Pilgrims landed in America. That Celtic belief in the supernatural, especially in spirit visitation and in the fact that God gave people certain gifts to help others, and that knowledge is passed on to them through their ancestors, and it represents a wisdom rather than an ignorance, and that it is also a world view that the supernatural is part of everyday life, and it is not in conflict with Christianity. In fact, it's probably just the opposite. It's a catalyst and an enhancement to the Christian beliefs of the Anglican, Catholic, or Episcopal, very Celtic viewpoint on religion.
Wow.
It's very strong in America. Because there's a huge DNA bank that goes back into the Celtic bloodlines of Americans. Almost everyone in America, either through direct bloodline or because an ancestor married someone, can either trace their DNA to Scots-Irish, which is the largest DNA, English, or Welsh. And so it is really, really strong. And there are certain areas that have kept the magic, so to speak. Almost all of Appalachia, from the Blue Ridge Mountains of West Virginia and Virginia down to the very southern tip of Georgia, that's an area where it's usually called mountain magic or the mountain religion. In areas of Boston, where you're going to find a large sect of Irish, San Francisco, where there's a large population of Irish, in parts of Louisiana, you know, because there was a large population of Irish and Scots in the New Orleans area. In fact, there's an area in New Orleans that's called the Irish Channel. It's near the riverfront area. It's very much ingrained in American cultural beliefs, but at the same time, a point I want to get across to people is that this is by no means unique to Celtic cultural people and beliefs. I grew up here in Southern California. Very similar beliefs are deeply rooted in what I call the California Hispanic culture. And by California Hispanic, I mean it's that culture of the Spaniards who came up here in the 1500s, and they came up from Mexico because California was Mexico at that time. And from that Spanish and then Mexican intermarriage, you have what I call California Hispanic. And it is very deeply rooted in the California Hispanic beliefs and day-to-day living. They may not talk about it as much as the Celtic culture does, but in the Celtic culture, we're very comfortable with it. And we do call it blood memory in the sense that through our blood, through our DNA, we do inherit, you know, attributes that we can see, the color of our eyes, the color of our hair, in my case, a little turn-up nose, you know, or a particular stature. But we also inherit spiritual attributes from our ancestors, and within those attributes are very particular talents. I don't know any other way to explain it. And you know, if I can give you a further explanation, just ask a question.
Yeah, I can't help but agree with what you're talking about with the Scottish side, because I come from, you know, from the McGregors is, you know, my side of the family, and on my mother's side, and they all have ability, and that's been passed on through Both my sister and me got our fair share. And my mother, who has four sisters, all have, you know, just this, we call it the sight.
Mm-hmm.
And in varying different skills. And to us, it's exactly what you were saying. It's that everyday thing to us. We grew up this way, not thinking mm-hmm. even twice about it, although we were careful, you know, because we knew there were certain, you know, groups that felt that that was, you know, something you didn't talk about, or they felt it was demonic in some
yes.
cases. But what I was really surprised to hear you say, and I'd like to know more. As a matter of fact, I want to stay in contact with you, was because the Episcopalian view, I really didn't know that, with that there was this whole acceptance of supernatural and you know, the sight, if you will, within that religion. So I mean, I'm blown away by what I just heard from you.
Yeah, in fact, just this past month I did a in-person with it's called the Chicklets, and it's a book club at the Episcopal Church I go to. The Episcopal Church I go to is a historic church in Southern California. It was built in the 1800s, and it's done in the old stone Gothic way. It's a church that you would expect to find on the East Coast. And I don't make too many in-person, you know, in your living room kind of visitations, but the Chicklets at the Episcopal Church, and this is actually a missionary, or I should say a ministry of the church. It's an officialized group of Trinity Episcopal Church that I go to. And they had asked me to show up because they had chosen my book one for their reading in the month of May. And here I am sitting around in this lovely, lovely living room sipping wine with about 25 mostly Episcopal women, but there were a couple there who were not from the Episcopal faith. And we're talking about blood memory, and we're talking about ghosts, and I'm trying to help them understand that if you feel like you've had a visit, a spirit visitation, one of the best things to do first and foremost is look to see if it's an ancestor. And I actually kind of give talks about how you can help identify it if it's an ancestor, because if it is an ancestor and there may have been a misinterpretation, or especially if it's with a child, and you know, children can have a very difficult time trying to explain a sighting of a spirit or a ghost. You don't want to scare them, because often
yeah.
If it's an ancestor, it's a protective spirit, and you want that protective spirit around you and your children. And the wife of one of our retired priests, I should explain, in the Episcopal faith, these are ordained priests, but in the Episcopal faith, an Anglican Catholic, priests are allowed to marry. And so I was kind of hesitant
about
when
time.
I started. Well, it's always been that way. Anyway, I was kind of hesitant to talk about this because I knew that just 2 months prior that there had been a very close member of their family who had died in a very sudden accident. And afterwards she came up to me and she said, I just so wish that Lou, and he was her husband, Father Lou, could have been here, because I almost didn't come. But then Cindy, another friend, said, no, you really, really should come. I think you'll feel good about this. And she said, I know that it was a son who had died. She said, I know my son has been in contact with us. And, you know, for that to come from the wife of a retired Episcopal priest, it really kind of hit home with me. The other thing that happened is that I laughed, and partly through, I said, well, thank goodness we're all Episcopal here and not fundamentalist. And two ladies stood up and go, we're fundamentalists. I said, okay, but I'm talking about fundamentalists with a small case F, not a capital F, like, you know, Catholic with a small C is different from Catholic with an uppercase C. And one of the ladies who was fundamentalist, probably in her 60s, grew up in the hills of Kentucky, and she said, Elizabeth, I know exactly what you mean. She said, in my family, what you're talking about, blood memory is handed down from one generation to the next, and it isn't evil. We consider it a gift from God. And yet the other lady who was there was much younger, and she said, well, I don't understand at all what you're talking about. And I said, well, I didn't mean to offend you, because I'm not talking about fundamentalists with a capital F. Okay, I'm talking about, and the Kentucky lady interrupted me and she said, we're talking about a very narrow mindset, dear.
Oh, my.
So,
oh, my.
You know, so,
well,
you know, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
It is very much part of the Episcopal, Anglican, Catholic beliefs. You know, like I said, keep in mind, this is the religion, the denomination that has in its possession and is guardian over the Book of Kells at Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland. So it shouldn't be surprising, you know, to anyone that, you know, if they're not familiar with the Episcopal faith or Anglican Catholic faith, that this is very much of our open belief that there can be spirits around us, and it's a good idea, you know, to find out if they are your ancestors, because you want to welcome them. And that's part of the nature, you know, the nature, representing the nature part of the ancient Celtic belief.
Why do you think that these spirits actually are, you know, let's say family members are coming around you? Do you feel like you reflect in your books that they're there, you know, trying to advise you or participate in life with you on a regular basis, or is it an exceptional type of circumstance that brings them out to help you?
John, I think it can be both. I think when there are people who have a particular gift or intuitive talent, and, you know, such as the character Shannon Delaney, her parents are dead. She really has no one around her to help her with this, and it's evolving, and she really doesn't know what to do. So there needs to be a guiding spirit, you know, quite literally a guiding spirit. And I think often our ancestral spirits will come back to guide us and show us the way. And yet in another example, I think that there are often times when we go through harrowing ordeals, and I think maybe an ancestor spirit or ghost will come back on a momentary basis to help us through those obstacles at that time period.
Well, I noticed in the book that you use, without giving anything away, that you use the basically ghosts that are appearing three-dimensional and as light, you know, lifelike as possible, which is actually referenced quite often in many you know, ghostly sightings. And I also, you know, it just seemed that there was a lot of personal experience there. So I'm kind of leading to the question, have you yourself had these kinds of experiences?
Yes, I have, in the sense that I have never had what I call a fully fleshed out apparition, but I have had what I call I try to think of how to explain this other than it's sort of a iridescent, silvery, black-gray shadow. But the shadow was in the form, and I knew exactly which grandparent it was from the physical stature and the overall physical nature of the shadow. I knew exactly who it was at the time that the person appeared. And this person appeared during the time of what I call quiet wakefulness. Now, I'm looking at the clock, and I'm thinking, are we going to go on break here real soon?
Actually, you know what? I am going to, because of our technical issues we had today, I'm just going to go ahead and just go straight through, because not only that, I don't want to break this interview. I'm actually rather enjoying the whole thing.
Okay.
So if we can beg everybody's patience, let's just go ahead and plow on through, because keep going.
Yeah, because I was about ready to bring up quiet wakefulness, and I didn't want to get into that and then go right into a break. But the one time when a very three-dimensional shadow person appeared to me was during a period of time in between segmented sleep that is referred to in the Celtic culture as quiet wakefulness. Now, this is a study that has gone back hundreds of years. In fact, when I was in Virginia and I was visiting at Monticello, that's the home that Thomas Jefferson built near Charlottesville, And afterwards, because all of my ancestry is Virginia, I have a way of being able to go after the docent afterwards and, you know, sort of talk with them about it, especially the areas that I'm visiting, because it's like, oh, yeah, my Corley family just lived down the road and so on and so forth. And I said, you know, I can remember reading through some of the text on Jefferson, and there were instances where the biographer said that in interviewing slaves, that slaves would often find Jefferson sitting up at the chair that's in his bedroom. And you'd have to kind of see the setup of Monticello to understand that Jefferson's bed was in between his library room and in between a sitting room, sort of like a very large hotel suite, for lack of a better description, and that slaves had described that Jefferson would get up in the wee hours of the morning and that he would be heard talking to someone. Well, the Scotsman, very well-known author, Robert Louis Stevenson, also wrote about this. He referred to quiet wakefulness as the perfect hour. What I'm talking about is that before we lived in a time that we do today of alarm clocks and time clocks, you know, before we set the alarm to wake up at 6 a.m. or whatever, and we said, oh, we've got to go to sleep at 10 p.m., people quite literally lived by their natural biorhythms. And I know biorhythm sounds really new age, but it isn't. In other words, people went to sleep at dusk, and people woke up to the rooster's crow. There was a lot more time of darkness to sleep than what there is now. So they would go to sleep, usually the segmented sleep. The first segment was 3 to 4 hours. That's the time that your body got its real physical rest that it needed. And then the mind would come to not complete a wide awake wakefulness, but almost a hypnotic state. That's what's referred to in Celtic culture as quiet wakefulness. And it is believed that at that point, before you go back to sleep and you sleep another 3 or 4 hours, that your body has reached a perfect point of complete physical rest, complete mental rest, and complete spiritual rest. So you are in complete, perfect balance. One of the rare times throughout anyone's life that you can be in complete, perfect balance. And when you are in perfect balance with all of nature, then the veil is a little bit thinner and you are more receptive to having, or welcoming, I should say, a spirit visitation, what we would call today a paranormal experience. And the one time when I actually had a three-dimensional shadow appear was at that time. I had been asleep about 4 hours, and I was just laying there. My eyes were kind of fluttering. My cat came up to lay beside me, and absentmindedly I was sort of petting the cat, and I felt the cat look in a certain direction. And I looked over in that direction, and there was the shadow, and I recognized it right away as a particular grandparent who had passed on actually quite some time ago. So in that aspect, when I write about the apparitions, I am kind of drawing from personal experience. What I tell people today, especially paranormal investigators, if you go out to a situation where children have experienced what they are trying to describe as a ghost, that would be the most common term, it could be happening to that child during that period, that in-between period of segmented sleep. To this day, children are more likely to experience that because they don't pay attention so much to waking up to the alarm clock or having to go to bed at a certain time. Plus, typically, especially the younger the child, we tend to put them to bed at an earlier time. The other experiences that I've heard people tell me about, as I talk with this among my parish at the Episcopal Church, is with retired people who have been retired for quite some time, and so they've gotten away from the alarm clock issue, and they can now go to sleep and wake up on their own natural biorhythms. And they have told me that quite often, you know, they have just sort of woke up after 3 or 4 hours sleep and they feel rested. They may want to go back to sleep, but they're sure that someone has visited them and that they're in the room there with them visiting. You know,
that
and it's...
Go on. Well, that's funny because I can say that my own experiences that I've had mirror that, where generally the types of visitations we've had here, and in our ranch we live on is haunted. We live on a haunted gold mine out here in Shingle Springs. It's in the gold country of California, Northern California. And we tend to notice that more of these experiences happen in that 4 or 5 hour time frame where we've been asleep and then wake up.
Mm-hmm.
Or we're actually just in the evening and we will see these shadows appear in the house. And they walk right through and walk right by us and we'll catch them out of the corner of our eye. And we do think they're family and, you know, appearing quite often. So, you know, what you're saying makes sense to me.
Yeah, and, you know, people will ask me, well, you know, does this happen most often, you know, during the wee hours of the morning or late at night because it's a witching hour or it's a particular time? And I'll say, I don't think so. I think it's happening because your body has reached a energy rest level of perfect balance. And so you are more receptive, you know, and that time, whatever that time is, that in between the two segments, is going to be different for everyone. But because so often today we work, you know, a 9-to-5 kind of Monday through Friday, I think more people experience it at probably a particular time period simply because of how we have trained ourselves to wake up and go to sleep by a clock.
So basically your almost advice is if you want to have these experiences more, get back to a natural rhythm as closely as possible.
Yes, if it is at all possible. And if you can't do it during a regular, you know, time period that you're working and you have to set your alarm clock, then if there's any way you can go on an extended vacation, you know, not a 1 week vacation, but maybe a 2 week vacation, and you can, because even when you go on a vacation, it's going to take probably, you know, maybe 3 or 4 days to get out of that habit. You know, because you've already trained yourself. So if you can go on an extended vacation and then really try to get into a natural biorhythm, it's probably more likely to happen to you. People, I suppose, could try to do it on their days off, but I don't know. I think that would be kind of difficult. But, you know, the other thing I wanted to say is that if you suspect, especially with children, if you suspect that it could be an ancestor's visitation that the spirit is, and with children that can be very difficult to determine because they might be scared and they may not understand what they're seeing. So one of the things that I tell people, and this kind of comes from my experience in doing genealogy, and I've taught genealogy, is to try and identify the spirit. You know, if the child can kind of describe the spirit, and one thing is to ask the child to, you know, first of all, if the child is laying down in the bed, get down at the child's level and try and see what they're seeing and ask them, well, is the spirit taller than, you know, the doorknob? You know, is the spirit taller than the light switch kind of thing? And then, you know, without scaring the child or without leading them, just maybe ask them to roughly draw what they think they saw. I know children are often frightened because they may have seen something that looks scary to them. One question I'm often asked is, why is it the spirit is either always white or always dressed in black or whatever? And I said, well, you know, if you're going back in time to even like the 1920s or before, people did dress in very drab clothing. And that was really, that's the truth of it. In summer they wore light clothing, and in winter they wore dark clothing. And our coats weren't different levels. Most of the time the coats were dark wool and they were to the ground. And I said that can be one reason. But with children, I have a wonderful website, it's not my website, but it's a free website, and it's called Dead Fred. Kids get a kick out of that name. It's on the web. It's www.deadfred.com. It is a website that has old photos on it, and you can search it. You can actually do a surname search. You might find your ancestors on there, but you can also search according to areas, according to years. And I tell people, go there and go into photos from the 1800s, and you'll see, especially in a group photo, how everyone looks alike. If it's summertime, they're all in floor-length white. If it's wintertime, they're all in dark clothing. And that often can help children or adults identify an overall characteristic of what they may have seen. And they can do it in a fun way. It's not frightening to go to that website. And it's perfectly free of charge. It's called deadfred.com. Great place for looking at old photos.
That's cool.
Other things that they can try to do is get an idea about how the ancestor died. That can be kind of difficult if you don't know, or if you're relying on family say-so, which often can be wrong. And so if you're trying to look up, if your ancestors are not buried near you, you can go to this other website, and this is free, and it's called findagrave.com. So that's www.findagrave.com. And you can search under, you can type in surnames. If you know, for instance, that the family member died in a particular area of Oregon, you can go to that place in Oregon, and you can search by cities or by cemeteries, and you can pull up information on graves and what's on the grave. And that's often a really good starting point. From there, you can go and look for death records and so on and so forth. But once you start to get an idea about what the ancestor did, you know, you can look at census records and find out what their occupation was, where they lived. That might explain why the farmer ancestor is standing with a pitchfork. He's not the devil, he's a farmer. That kind of thing.
Do you think that the act of doing these genealogical searches of your own family might promote them then to, if they see you're taking an interest in them and wanting, I guess literally, to make their lives part of your own, it actually will bring them to you in some respects?
I think it could. I think it would at least, you're kind of putting out the welcome mat. You're saying, you're my ancestor, I welcome you here. And often, I think ancestor spirits come back for a very spectral purpose. You know, I don't know if it's in book one or in book two, but it's actually said as far as the Scottish magician, who is the main ghost, and he's a very helpful ghost, that he believes he has a spectral purpose to his spirit-driven life. And so he's here for a reason. I believe that if our ancestors, especially if they come back more than once, that they're trying to communicate that they're here for a reason. One lady, when I was at this meeting of Episcopal women, she told me, she said, I know my granddaughter, who's only, I think the granddaughter is about 7 years old, is seeing her uncle. And this would be like the lady's, the grandmother's brother, that she's seeing the uncle, and the uncle is trying to convey something to her, but I'm not sure what. But she said, it feels good. And I've told my granddaughter not to be afraid of this uncle, and I've tried to tell her things about him. You know, and it turns out that this granddaughter has a tremendous interest in animals, and right now at the age of 7 she wants to be a veterinarian, and that this uncle was a veterinarian, but he was in Wales. This lady is Welsh, and she's living out here in California, and he was in Wales, and so he's not communicating very well because the accent is very thick, and they don't quite understand it. But you know, it will eventually come through. But yes, I think if you can at least determine who the ancestor is, that may be the key to why they're here. Case in point, a fellow that I went to school with told me this story. He went back to live in the upper Midwest, and he is of, I can't remember if it's Swedish or Norwegian, but I think it's Swedish ancestry. He went back to live on his great-grandparents' farm. He retired. He went back there. It has several acres on it. They lived in the old farmhouse while they built a new house. They moved into the new house. His daughter moved into the old farmhouse. She wanted to take up gardening. Her children went off to camp, and this was toward the end of summer. Her husband was at work all day. She had taken vacation because she was looking through seed catalogs.
Mm-hmm.
And she left the seed catalogs out on her kitchen table. She'd get up in the morning, and they had been flipped through. And she's going, you know, I don't think my husband's doing this because he could care less about me wanting to plant all of these bulb gardens, you know, irises and tulips and so on and so forth. Well, she was doing dishes, and she was hearing voices, and she wasn't quite sure what the voices were saying. So she started recording them on her digital voice recorder. She recorded a few. She played them back to her husband, who was, I wouldn't say that he was a believer or a non-believer. He was open. And he said, why don't you take that to church next week and see if anyone recognizes the voices? So she took it to church. Now, this is an old farm community. It's generational. And one of the ladies there said, oh, that's Swedish. And she said, my husband can interpret that for you. She took the digital recorder home. Her husband interpreted it. It was a lady's voice, and the lady was telling her where to plant these particular bulbs. I forget if they were tulips or irises. That prompted the woman to go to the local library, which was also the Historical Society, and do some research. Well, keep in mind that she's living in the original farmhouse that would have been her great-grandparents. Turns out her great-grandmother was known for her bulb gardens, which had gone to weed over these many generations. And the great-grandmother was telling her the best places to plant the tulips.
Oh, my God.
So she was doing it in Swedish, you know, and that was a language that the great-granddaughter never had even heard or did not speak. And
you know, it's funny.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
You know, so, I mean, there could be a purpose there. You know, the story has a happy ending. She ended up planting the bulbs where her great-grandmother had planted them because she was able to go to the library and get photos of this award-winning garden. And, you know, if the voice, the voice was never heard again, but she definitely said that she feels really good when she goes out to work in the garden. She feels very, very close to her ancestors.
Well, you know what? I'm a gardener myself, and I could use her coming over to work with me on mine. I got some work to do on mine, and I could use that. If I could find somebody to do the Swedish for me, I'll take it. But, you know, what's funny is in 1993, I flew out to Maui. And I had the opportunity, I was there on vacation, and I had the opportunity to talk with different folks that were there and really got to know the culture a bit. But what I was surprised at was when I flew back, I work in aerospace, and I was flying back and forth to our Southern California Electronics Satellite Division, and I was down there doing work. And I got talking to a Hawaiian gentleman that was working in the computer room there. And he started taking up where I had left off with what I learned from the people in Maui and explained to me how important and how central ancestors were to their day-to-day lives. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he says, well, you know, we include them in everything, even in our meals and the way we do things. And I said, do you actually, you know, are they participating in decisions? And he says, oh, yes, oh, all the time. And I was just fascinated. I looked and went, how can that be? And this was before I really got, you know, serious about the paranormal. And I looked at it, and I was very open because I understood it from, you know, my own Celtic history. but not to the degree that the Hawaiians did it. And I just thought, well, that's neat. And as, you know, things have gone on, you know, in our own life here on the ranch with my father, who's just had a stroke here 2 years ago, and we've had all these occurrences with family coming in, and it seems to have escalated recently. I'm just more and more convinced that, you know, that is a good way to do things and to really, you know, take it forward from there and actually maybe get to know them through the genealogical history like you're talking about. So I wrote those sites down and think that's a good direction to go.
You know, there's another site. You'll love this if you want to get into it. And this, you know, there are so many sites out there in genealogy, it can be overwhelming. I like to give just a few sites that serve a very esoteric purpose. This next site I'm going to give you is called the Encyclopedia of Genealogy. It is also free, and it's www.eogen.com. Those initials stand for Encyclopedia of Genealogy. It's sort of a catch-all in the sense that it truly is an encyclopedia. You can do an index search, you know, A through Z alpha search. But one of the places on there you should go to is called Heritage Quest. So from the eogen.com site, you go to the index, you choose H, and you just follow the H's down to Heritage Quest. And Heritage Quest Online will have listings there according to the states, whatever state you live in. You can find which library offers Heritage Quest Online free. This is a free service. There are just, you know, hundreds of libraries in the U.S. that allow free access to it. You can go to the library, get a secret code from the library, and go home and access it from your own computer, or you can use the computers in the library. Heritage Quest has census records. What most people don't realize is that following the American Revolution of 1776, we have taken federal government census since 1790, every 10 years in every state. And you can follow your ancestors as they migrate out of the 13 colonies into other areas. You find out all about them. And then there are other census records, too. There's, like, tax census and, you know, and so on and so forth. So it's a really good starting point. Once again, Encyclopedia of Genealogy on the World Wide Web, eogen.com. And you go to the index. It's an alpha index. Go to H and then go to Heritage Quest. Find Heritage Quest has like three or four categories depending on the state. You know, it's like an alpha listing, Alaska through kind of thing. And it's a really good place to start. I tell everyone, I mean, it's fun to get to know your ancestors. I can look back at some of my ancestors, and I know that there are some that are a little bit closer to me than others, and I know from which I've inherited certain DNA talents spiritually as well as physically, and it's kind of comforting to know from where that came from. You know, at least it is for me. But it's a really, really good starting point for families who may be having paranormal experiences, because I think it's very important that you need to start from a elimination process. You want to rule out whether this is a good spirit, okay? And if it's a good spirit, you want to welcome them, and especially if it's an ancestral spirit, because they're going to help protect you, and they're going to help guide you.
Okay, well, this has been awesome. I have got to have you back again, because you are absolutely a fount of knowledge. I mean, there's just, I've written out, all my show notes are totally marked up. I was madly scribbling everything you put down.
And just tell me what it is that you want, and I'll send them as a target in the email.
Okay.
I will start booking again for October, because book two, which is out in ebook, my books come out in ebook first and then go to paperback. Paperback version of book two will be out in October. And then probably the ebook version of book three will be out early next year. So I will be booking again come October, November.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, I'll get it in early. Yeah, and I was just going to ask you, you're the best guest because you get all the questions before I can think of them. I was just thinking, so early next year for the book three in ebook format. And you have actually two websites. You have the, as a matter of fact, just go ahead and give them on the air, HTTP.
Okay.
And then.
I only have one website. If you're talking about the .com, that's not any good. The major website that I have is, and it's my name, Elizabeth, as in Queen Elizabeth, Egan, that's the hard part. People get that one wrong. EAGAN Cox, COX dot net. So all together it is www.elizabethecox.net.
Okay. So, yeah, and we'll definitely keep that one on the active list. I'm going to be checking that for sure. And we did have a question from Doc John that was basically about scents, actually picking up smells with regard to ghosts. Is that something you've ever had happen here in the next 3 minutes before we end?
Only once, and it was a burning. It was like a wood smoke. Kind of smell. And what I attribute that to is that my grandfather Jesse, who I knew, he would always remind me that whenever you strike a match, you douse it. And to this day, I do that. And we use wood stoves. And so we're striking matches often where I live. And sometimes when you get up in the morning and you're just really, really sleepy and you've got to start a fire in the wood stove, you may forget to douse that match. And that happened one time, and I can remember that burning, smoky smell. And it was like, oh, yes, okay, Grandpa, I'll go douse the match.
Okay, so that has happened. And so I hope that helps Doc John, who's going to actually be our guest next week and talk about some of his experiences. So we'll be getting together with him to get show notes just like we did for you. And we wanted to thank you, Elizabeth, for being on with us. Again, I am really stoked at this show. This really was interesting. And I will definitely get with you for an October booking. So thank you so much for coming here with us.
Thank you. And I really enjoyed it. And I'd love to come back and talk maybe about grave art, because people don't realize that gravestones tell more of a story than just the name and dates.
Grave art? I'm going to... that. You know something? I love the stuff I see at gravesites. So you got a deal. It's going to be about grave art, and I will get with you here this coming week to set it up. So you've got a deal, my friend.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much, John and
okay.
Kat. And
yes.
Ghost Riders of NorCal.
Okay, thank you. God bless.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Well, Kat, thank you so much for saving the day with our technical issues. And, hey, let's do the shout-outs for everybody. And let's see. Who we got? Kat, are you on there? You can see them.
I have Brad G., Doctor, Guest, 6972, Guest 7221, Hunter, Infinite Love, Journey Paranormal,
hi,
and
Sharon.
Phil.
Okay, well, hey, everybody, thank you very much for attending tonight. It's always a privilege to have you guys visit. Sharon, hey, good to see you. I'm going to be on Hornet with you on my birthday, my 50th birthday, July 11th. And, Doc, I'll be in touch with you for the show next week. Get ready because we're going to put you through quite a question and answer session. And to everyone else, hey, thank you, guys. We really just appreciate you a bunch. So, and that said, we're coming up at the end of it, 10 seconds. And, Kat, thank you once again.
You're welcome.
And goodbye to everybody, and God bless. This is Ghost Rider Paranormal Radio. Thanks a lot, Kat. Sure appreciate it.
That's okay.
Okay. And with that, we're off the air. Good night, everybody.
Good night.